Hello, and welcome to The More Perfect Union, the podcast that offers real debate without the hate. I'm Kevin Kelton. I'm a writer and social media political activist from Los Angeles, California.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Kushmider. I'm a social policy advocate with a cold from Kensington, Maryland.
Hi, I'm DJ McGuire, a cost estimator and musician with a Kahlua and milk from Suffolk, Virginia.
Hi, I'm Greg Matuszak, a former political activist and teacher with a recovering from the flu. Woo, that was tough. From Cincinnati, Ohio.
Cool. And we want to remind everybody to look for us on moreperfectunionpodcast.com and on Twitter at #MPUpodcast. So this week, unfortunately, we have to revisit a topic that comes up all too often, which is mass shootings. And in the case of this week, the school shooting in Florida. Obviously, everybody is saddened by it. Obviously, everybody hopes that there's going to be progress made on the front of violence in our society. Rebecca, how did this hit you, and where do you think things should go from here?
You know, I've been active on gun violence prevention since Sandy Hook. This is something I've worked with different groups as a volunteer. I've written about it extensively for a number of different outlets. And it's discouraging. It's hard to see it happen yet again. It's draining emotionally to have to go through all the emotions over and over again and to know that the outcomes so seldom change. And I'm feeling a deep sense of shame after seeing one of the kids from the high school on TV saying that adults were supposed to keep them safe, and we didn't do it. And I think that is a national failure on our part.
And speaking of failures, the FBI apparently had some leads on him, as well as the local police. There were 20 visits to his home. But DJ, is that the bigger part of the story, or do you think it comes back again to what do we do about guns?
I think it is the bigger part of the story, even though it will not be one that's looked at. Not necessarily the FBI falling down on the job. That is, of course, an outrage that should be investigated. It will be investigated. And hopefully the FBI will improve in terms of how they respond to tips like this, including, you know, following their own policy for once. But the fact of the matter is, this was a failure on the local police level, and it was a failure on the local police level due to white privilege. There's no other way to put it. If Nicolas Cruz were actually Hispanic instead of adopted into an apparently Hispanic family, or if he were black, or frankly, if he were a Muslim, he would have been in juvenile hall, or most certainly in jail, on the 14th of February 2018 instead of at Parkland School. And given the things that he did, he shot at a neighbor's chicken. He tried to kill a neighbor's pig. There's a farm nearby, I guess. He stole a neighbor's mail. He threw eggs at a neighbor's car while they were driving it. And he bit a child. Under normal circumstances, there would at least be charges against this person that would have made it difficult, not impossible, for them to purchase a weapon, which Mr. Cruz did last February. And again, he probably would be in jail for a certain period of time, including right now, before he could get to Parkland. None of that happened, I believe, because he was white.
Well, and he was also, I should note that he was also known to have abused his ex-girlfriend and gotten in a fight with the young man she started dating after they broke up. So there's that seed of misogyny that seems to be at the root of so many of these mass acts of violence.
And we do not pay attention to it as much as we should because we don't like to get involved in what we think are quote-unquote lover's quarrels. Well, when a lover's quarrel involves somebody getting bruised, yeah, that's something we need to get involved in. The simple fact of the matter, I mean, this was a failure from start to finish. And while there are going to be a number of people who want to discuss gun availability and such, and I can understand that, what I would make sure we don't do is ignore the role that white privilege played in this guy walking the streets when he should not have been. Because, I hate to put it this way, white privilege killed 17 people last week.
Okay, so fair enough, but I'm very sincere when I ask you this. What could have been done? I mean, he bit a child. I don't know the circumstances of that. Obviously, on some level, that's accosting someone. But you know,
it's assault.
Are you going to? It's assault. Are you going to arrest someone?
I mean,
I don't know the details.
You can arrest
shooting
someone.
At a chicken, throwing eggs at a car, stealing mail. You know, again, it's a federal offense, but.
Yeah, it is a federal offense. It is an offense. He broke the law on several occasions. Theft and attempted destruction of property. Assault.
The young man is a violent criminal. He's a violent criminal. I mean, they were technically misdemeanors and not felonies, but he's a violent person.
So going forward, what would you have the authorities do? I mean, should
I would have the I would have the authorities stop giving passes to white kids who do this. That's the first and foremost thing that every local police unit needs to take away from this. That is a tragically tall order. Right. Don't go nice on them because they're white.
Insurmountably difficult to suggest. I'm kind of breathless. I mean, you're not wrong. I'm just saying that that is a huge, huge paradigm shift.
I would agree it's a huge paradigm shift, but I do not think it is a larger paradigm shift. In fact, I think it's a smaller paradigm shift than convincing tens of millions of our fellow Americans to partially or fully disarm. That's going to be a much bigger road to hoe than getting white privilege thinking out of local police forces.
I don't know. Wait a second. I think it'd be difficult to arrest every child who's thrown an egg at a car and then clog up the judicial system, especially even the juvenile judicial system, and say, well, you know, this was a crime or stole a neighbor's mail or things like that. And you're right. Some of the stuff seems petty, but when you put it all together, there's definitely a pattern. Maybe if they looked at the bigger picture. Additionally, how much of this was done before he was 18 and his record was sealed? There's a lot maybe I don't really know about this also. Were these police officers thinking they were doing the right thing by giving this kid a break? It's hard to know the whole story.
But intimate partner violence and getting expelled from school for fighting, those are very obvious red flags. They should be very hard to overlook.
Yeah, but he was expelled from school for it. Again, I'm not really arguing with you. I'm very genuine here. You know, we all have kids. We're not going to get into the specifics of our families. But, you know, you don't want the police to pick up your kid because he threw eggs at a car. Or, you know, or he had an argument with someone and he said, I'll fucking kill you. Again, it's a tall order to expect the police, the FBI, the authorities, whoever that be, to read minds and to predict the future.
The point that DJ's making, and I agree with him, is that the throwing eggs at a car, the white kid gets the, you know, the pat on the shoulder from the cops and the don't do that again. And even when they then steal the mail 2 weeks later, they get the, come on, kid, I already warned you about this once. And a white kid gets a benefit of the doubt that a child of color wouldn't get.
You are absolutely right. You are absolutely right.
I don't disagree. I think, DJ, you hit on a very good point. However, my concern is, now I agree with you, DJ, but my concern is adding race to this mix. I think that only will serve to make coming to a solution harder instead of easier.
Well, considering that most shooters are white men, maybe profiling them isn't such a bad idea.
And lastly, to answer Rebecca's, do you want the police coming to schools every time there's a fight at a school? Every time a punch is thrown, every time two boys push each other or something, do you want an arrest made?
Yes. You know why? And I've been saying this for a while, actually. No, I wrote about this a few years ago in relation to conversations about bullying, when bullying becomes physical. I think if you lay hands on another person, you should be arrested. It should become a law enforcement issue, maybe not prosecuted. But I think that carting kids off in handcuffs in a cop car would send a hell of a message to keep your hands to yourself and stop picking on one another. I think the consequence of if you are literally beating on one of your fellow students, going to the office and going to detention or whatever, that's not a strong enough answer to what that actually is. Physical assault is physical assault.
Okay. I'm going to kind of jump in here and bring it back to what I think is the issue, which is guns.
Yeah, I was wondering what took you so long.
And I've had a personal metamorphosis on this issue this week. As you know, I've always been more anti-gun than pro-gun rights. I'm not a fan of the Second Amendment. I've said that before. I know that bothers a lot of people, but I'm being honest. But I've become, I think this week, an extremist on the topic. I think I've become radicalized. I think everything that you guys have pointed at so far, you make valid points. Obviously, this is a complex problem. There's not one aspect of it that's the entire solution. But I still come back to, you know, kids who have fights, kids who bite other kids who throw eggs at cars. If they don't have access to AR-15s, they don't shoot 17 people to death. And this week, I have become, you know, there are people in my party that I would consider radical about healthcare. They want single payer. There are people on the other party who are radical about taxes. They think the taxes should be zero or should be a minimum. On any subject, there are people who go to the extreme. And on this, I am now an extremist. And I will say, if I had the power to push a button and repeal or rewrite the Second Amendment, I'd do it in a heartbeat. I know it's not going to happen, but I think it should happen. And I am going to part with my party. I'm going to part with the people who talk about, quote unquote, sensible gun safety laws and people who say, we don't want to come for your weapons. Let me state my case on this. If you own a handgun, a shotgun, or another reasonable weapon for self-defense and you keep it stored in your home safely, I have no problem with that. If you're a hunter and you have hunting weapons, I have no problem with that. If you have a valid reason to have a concealed carry permit, or you keep a gun for business or security reasons, I have no problem with that. Everybody else, I'm coming for your guns. I'm coming for your AK-47s. I'm coming for your AR-15s. I'm coming for your bump stocks. I'm coming for anything that makes no sense for an individual to own. And if I've offended some of our listeners, I apologize, but I really don't, because I think that this is madness. And I think until we come to a place where we go back to some form of the assault weapons ban. I know that that 10-year law was not perfect. It had a lot of loopholes. I'm not saying that we should necessarily reinstitute that, but I think we need something like it. And I'm going to hold out for a politician that supports that. And I, just one other thing. I know that I've spoken very long here. I'm very disappointed in my party this week. Where's been the leadership on this? I did see Bernie Sanders on one of the morning shows this morning, but that's the first time I've heard him speak about it. I haven't heard Elizabeth Warren make a peep about it. Kirsten Gillibrand sent out one tweet this morning on it. It's not enough. You want to be a leader of my party, you have to have the guts to stand up to the NRA and the guts to stand up to assault weapons.
The problem with that, though, is, and this is why so many of them have been silent, is that this has fallen into an unfortunate pattern. We start with the incident itself. Usually within the first 24 hours, there are calls for greater gun regulation. There are calls for increasing calls to change the Second Amendment in some way, to give the government more power to either do mandatory buybacks or gun confiscation of some kind or some kind of control. And then what happens is data comes out that reveals that, one, outside of actual confiscation or mandatory buybacks, most regulations would not have impacted the particular incident itself. Or two, what was more dramatically happened in this case was that there was serious failure with local and federal law enforcement. And I want to focus on that last bit, Kevin, because what you are essentially asking for, and what really most people on the gun control side and even many on the gun regulation side, and I'm separating the two now, what most of them really are looking for is they are looking for the tens of millions of Americans who are gun owners to voluntarily disarm either partially or fully. That's what you're looking for, because you're looking for them to disarm themselves, whether it's a matter of the government comes in and says, we are taking your guns, and they submit, or whether they voluntarily hand it over in some way, shape, or form.
But no, I'm not saying there aren't other people that may be advocating that. I'm not. Go ahead.
Well, the way you said, when you say I'm coming for your guns, it's pretty obvious you want some people to disarm.
you're focusing on the second part of what I said. You missed the entire first
part. No, I did hear the first part. The point I'm trying to make is that if you want those people to disarm themselves in any way, shape, or form, no matter.
No, I'm not talking about disarming. They can have handguns. They can have hunting weaponry. They can have, rifles.
Kevin, it is...
They can have shotguns.
Right, but it...
So that's different than disarmament.
But it is still partial disarmament. Maybe not full disarmament, but partial disarmament. My point is...
Okay, I'm not going to have a semantic argument with you. Go ahead.
I know, and I understand. The point I'm trying to get is you want these people, this group of people, to trust their local, state, and federal governments to protect them more than they trust them now. And this kind of incident is the kind of thing that will get them to trust their local and federal governments less than they trusted them last week.
That's their problem.
Well, that may be their problem, but they vote too.
Yeah, that's right. And we're going to outvote them. We're going to have to outvote them.
But the problem is, I don't think you will. I actually think, will certainly...
You're probably right, DJ, but you know what?
Wait, hang on.
A man can dream.
Did you just say I was that I'm probably right in making a prediction? Let's think on that.
No, he didn't. He wasn't. Okay. He's not that drunk.
Just so we're clear here, but this is one that, clearly it has energized many in both the gun control and gun regulation community. That much is obvious. But I think what we now know about the local and federal government enforcement failures will also energize the gun rights community. I don't see this leading to any short-term change. It may lead to long-term change if the two sides start talking to each other. And then the question for that is, has this shocked enough people in the gun rights community that they're willing to say, okay, let's talk to the other side and let's figure out what we can agree on?
The answer to that question is a resounding no.
I'm not so sure
about
that.
It's a no.
I'm not so sure about that.
No, the gun rights community does not want to change anything. I've been tracking this for years. There have been all kinds of middle ground solutions that have been advocated, including closing the boyfriend loophole, where if you're convicted of domestic violence against a person to whom you're not married, that doesn't carry with it a revocation of gun permits. There is technology available to make smart guns that can be keyed to a watch or a fingerprint like your phone are. And there are states that have automatic laws that would require that all guns in the state be sold with that technology on it if any state starts selling it. And, well, Maryland tried to sell those guns, and there were protests and threats against the store that was trying to sell them. That technology would do so much to prevent accidents in the home of little kids picking up a gun and going, hey, what's this? But the gun rights community won't allow them to be sold because they don't want to pay for the extra piece of hardware. They are not going to come around on any of this. Both sides are entrenched. I don't know what the answer is, but I was listening to another podcast. I was listening to Pod Save America this week, and Jon Favreau, a former Obama speechwriter, was saying, this is not a bug in the system. This is not a flaw. This is not because the GOP is under the influence of the NRA. This is what they actually believe. They want more access to guns. It's part of their party platform, and it's not going anywhere. I don't know how to change it, but somebody said that the gun debate was effectively over the day we walked away from Sandy Hook and said that 20 dead children, babies, was okay.
See, I'll disagree. And this is why. And I think this week changed the whole debate. We have a large group of students who are media savvy and who have taken it upon themselves because the adults in the room are not. And they are ready. They've planned boycotts, and they are going to influence a much younger generation to take on this cause. And it may not happen within the next 3 days. It may not happen in the next 3 months. It may not happen in the next 3 years. But this group of survivors from this Florida school, I think are going to be the spark that you're going to see that within a generation, that this group of young people are going to make it where it will not be acceptable for young people to say things like, oh, I have an AR-15. And they'll say, no, wait, that's ridiculous. How could you do that? We know survivors. And they'll say, oh, I'm sorry. It will not be acceptable in America for that behavior.
I hope you're right. I really hope you're right.
This is where it starts. Yeah. And that's not a DJ prediction.
No, that's fine. But the fact of the matter is, most Americans who do own weaponry, they have the same goals that frankly you and Kevin and Rebecca have. They want to feel safer themselves, and they want to help their community feel safe. They just have an entirely different methodology than the three of you do.
And the question is
getting those wires to touch. David French in National Review Online mentioned something that California does. It's called a gun violence restraining order, where if you present evidence to a judge that says, look, this person has done XYZ PDQ, much like the stuff that the anonymous acquaintance of Mr. Cruz tipped the FBI on January 5th, then a judge can go, okay, this person's right to keep and bear arms is revoked for 21 days, 6 months, a year because of this serious problem or this serious list of issues. That's something California's had for quite some time, and it is something that focuses on individual responsibility in a way that many in the gun rights community can accept. That's one place where the wires can touch, and that's just one example.
So we promised ourselves before the podcast started that we wouldn't let this topic take over the podcast. And of course,
podcast has fallen in the way of my predictions.
Yes. So we're going to wrap this up. But I do want to just make one last comment on this topic. There are going to be listeners who are upset that we didn't have someone who advocated for the other side of the issue. And we understand that. But I do want to address people who believe very passionately in gun rights. You say gun laws don't work. You know, the Second Amendment is sacrosanct. It's my right to own this, that, or the other. And I just want to ask this question. What more do you want? There are already 300 million guns in this country. There are already 5 million AR-15s on the loose in this country. There are enough AK-47s in the world for one out of every 60 people to own one. But if we don't do something now, those 5 million AR-15s are going to become 10 million, and it's going to become 15 million. And that 300 million guns is going to become 600 million, and then 800 million, and then a billion. And the shootings will, instead of being once every month like this one, they'll be once a week. They really will be once a week mass killings in this country. We have to do something now to stop from getting there. That's my point. That's what I'd like you to think about.
The More Perfect Union, real debate without the hate, now heard on iTunes and Blog Talk Radio.
You know what? I'd like to take a moment to talk about the fact that we do have some happy news this week. We are welcoming back one of our sponsors. HelloFresh has returned to the More Perfect Union fold.
HelloFresh.
They saw the error of their ways and they came back and said, please tell the public how wonderful we are. And they are wonderful. I've used the product. Who else here has used the HelloFresh product?
Oh, I just used HelloFresh last night. We had Monterey Jack cheeseburgers with red onion jam.
How was it?
It was delicious, actually. It was really, really good.
And really difficult and complicated to make, right?
Oh my God, I slaved all day. No, it was slapping some burgers on a skillet. It was so easy. The instructions were really easy to read. It was great.
Yeah, HelloFresh really does. If you haven't tried it, HelloFresh makes it so easy to cook these delicious balanced dinners, and they do it for less than $10 a meal.
I've been able to do it I've been able to do it while standing in my kitchen watching football on Sunday, just sitting there, you know, looking up, looking down, looking up, looking down, and doing what I need to do. The instructions are relatively easy. My wife is actually impressed with my cooking skills, which really I've only developed from using this stuff. So I would say it's very good, and the food is very good. I would almost say it's good enough to replace food stamps, but that's a whole different other problem.
Oh, let's not go there.
No more time-consuming meal planning or grocery shopping. They deliver everything you need right to your doorstep. All the ingredients come pre-measured in a handy, labeled meal kit, so you know which ingredients go with which recipe. They have three meal plans to choose from. They're called the Classic, Veggie, which is obviously vegetarian, and the Family Plan. Rebecca, you tried the Family Plan, I think,
yeah,
right?
I tried the Family Plan. It fed my family of four beautifully. With minimal whining from my children.
And if you knew her children, you'd know that that's quite an accomplishment. with kid-tested recipes made specifically with families like Rebecca's in mind, easy-peasy ravioli gratin with spinach, thyme, and Parmesan breadcrumbs is one of their signature meals. You can try things you never thought to cook before. I know that I learned to cook some meals that I would never have attempted if I didn't have these, you know, these six-step recipes that they make it so easy for you. So you can enjoy cooking and eating outside of your comfort zone. It's not going to be the same pasta or the same steak or the same chicken that you've been serving your family for eons. For $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter MorePerfect30. That's the words More Perfect and the number 30, no spaces, no capital letters. That's our code, and you'll get $30 off your first order. So please try HelloFresh. We're happy to have them back on the More Perfect Union. And with that in mind, happy eating.
Can we get back to politics now? Yo. Sorry.
That's a Hamilton quote. I caught it.
That was a great Hamilton quote there.
Great.
Now I'm hungry, actually.
So let's go to happier stories, like the way the Russians have infested and taken over our electoral process. That's something that we could be, you know, kumbaya about.
Yeah, we can all agree that that's like a bad thing, right? Like we're all on the same page on that we are not cool with that.
Well, as you know, anybody who reads a newspaper or watches cable news knows, Robert Mueller this week announced the indictment of 13 Russians. Actually, it was Rod Rosenstein at the DOJ who announced the indictment of 13 Russians, which, by the way, I think was a very strategic decision on their part. And apparently Rick Gates today came out that he was taking a plea deal, and he'd agreed to testify against Paul Manafort on the money laundering charges, which are going to tie into the Russian efforts to sway the election. Guys, do you think Mueller has anything more in his arsenal? Not to
use gun imagery?
Yeah, not to use gun imagery.
I mean, Mueller is clearly conducting an exhaustive investigation into all of these people and their dealings over a period of many years. So who knows what he's going to come up with next? The fact that he's charging Russian nationals and Russian entities is very, very interesting, because that leaves no doubt in anyone's mind that there was Russian influence. There's, you know, obviously room for debate whether the Russian bots changed anyone's mind or not. I don't think there's room for debate, but others do. And it makes it very hard for anyone to deny that these things are happening when people are actually being charged. Now, how do you charge people in Russia and actually get anything done? Don't know. But it definitely is, you know, throwing down a gauntlet and saying this thing happened. Whether or not the Trump campaign was complicit in it, that's still an open question.
Right. So since this announcement, I believe Trump has put out, I'm going to say 16 tweets. I think there were 5 this morning concerning this, the indictments. And all of them have been really just proclaiming his innocence. And not one has said anything bad actually about the Russians. Like, hey, this really stinks that you guys did this. Or, hey, don't. Or, you know, or you're not going to do this again or anything. Or even like, I don't even like borscht.
Yeah, exactly. He's taken Rosenstein's qualifier, which said that nothing involved in that particular indictment impacted the 2016 election calculations, as in, you know, there are still people out there who believe that Russians hacked into the voting machines and changed the totals. Rosenstein was basically saying, no, that has nothing to do with this indictment. And Trump took that and assumed that it means the investigation has moved on from the collusion discussion. It has not moved on from the collusion discussion. This is a broad-based investigation. It has many parts. And this was the Russian trolls and social media radicalizing people to vote for Trump part. Or to vote for Bernie Sanders.
Right.
Yes, I said that.
Or Jill Stein.
Let me just jump in and kind of, not correct, but maybe put a different spin on something you just said, DJ. Trump doesn't believe that it proves that there was no collusion. He's trying to get stupid people to believe it.
Fair enough.
He knows what he knows. He knows what happened. I happen to believe that there was collusion. It will either be proved or disproved by Mueller and his team. But Trump knows what went down, and he is acting like a guilty man, not an innocent
man. Well, we know there was attempted collusion. We know that for a fact. What we don't know is how successful the attempted collusion was. That's what we don't know yet.
Well, it's because they called Don Jr. I mean, if you're going to attempt to collude, call someone smarter.
Right. And he keeps saying, oh, I've talked to Putin, and he says he didn't do it, so I feel pretty good about it. Which, did anyone see the editorial in, I want to say New York Magazine or New York Post? It was one of those two.
The New York Post. It was one of the tabloid ones, right?
It might have been, where they say it's obvious at this point, because Trump will not call out anybody, that someone has something on Trump. And we have a pattern now of Trump paying for sex. We now have a pattern with the Playboy model who has come out and said, this is how my life was, of him paying for me for several years, and this is how I would get payments. The porn star, the two porn stars, and he has a pattern of paying, let's say, adult actresses of sex. Someone's got something on him. It was and the fact that he will not come out against this obvious indictment, someone's got something on him. It's a really interesting editorial. If you can find it, it's in New York something. I know New York only has like one or two magazines.
Yeah,
it's not a very literary town.
Okay, so let's get back to politics, specifically the immigration bills that both crashed and burned in the Senate this week. DJ, what do you think? Are they going to do anything, or was that it? Was that our last vestige of an attempt?
That's pretty much it. Nothing will actually get out of the Senate. And nothing was going to get out of the House anyway. There are Democrats who only want the legalization or authorization, excuse me, for Dreamers. There are Republicans who want some border security, but nothing to do with ratcheting down legal immigration. And there are Republicans who will only accept ratcheting down legal immigration for anything. And between those three groups won't talk to each other, and none of them have a majority in either house of Congress. So we are stuck with the status quo until the status quo ends. It will end for most of the Dreamers on March 5th. There are some who've managed to get themselves extended through courts, through court rulings and such. But sadly, we will see more deportation of children. And maybe that will be something that gets people's attention. But right now, I don't see anything changing.
Well, hasn't gotten anyone's attention, so I don't see why deportation will.
Yeah. And what's galling is Trump was out on Twitter saying, oh, Democrats are failing the Dreamers. Republicans are still working. And I'm thinking, dude, this wouldn't be a problem if you hadn't made it one.
Yeah.
It's literally a problem he invented, and now he's mad at us for not.
No, that's not what he's doing. There is a difference between a Trump lie, which is just because Donald Trump's lying about himself, and a Republican lie. That is a Republican lie that is designed to demoralize Democrats into thinking that demoralize Democratic voters into thinking that their elected officials bear some responsibility for this, when the most they can do is filibuster for about a week and a half until some of the more weak-kneed members of the Senate caucus flee and run for the hills. There is little to nothing that the Democratic Party can do in their current position except convince the American people to elect more Democrats in November. Trump knows this or not, the Republicans around him do, and they are telling him to spout that lie to discourage Democratic voters. So to the Democratic voters who are listening to this podcast, do not fall for that crap.
When is the next time the debt ceiling comes around? Do we have to wait another year, or is it another?
The debt's
another year.
The debt ceiling is next.
That's over. It's over. March.
But there's another government funding bill that comes up March 23rd.
With the government, okay. So 23rd of March. So if the Democrats this time say, "Hey, we're serious this time," you have to include funding. Could that happen?
It could
theoretically.
At most, it will shut the government down for a week until about a dozen Democrats in the Senate run scared, because the American people have made this abundantly clear. No matter what the issue is, no matter why it happened, the American people don't like shutdowns. And if someone is saying we are shutting down the government to enact a certain policy or a certain change in policy, the voters will go, "Oh, it's your fault." Now, Donald Trump nearly stepped into that when he said, "Oh, I want a shutdown to ratchet down legal immigration," but then the shutdown didn't happen because everybody wanted to spend money. So if the voters think Donald Trump caused the shutdown, then they will blame him. If voters think Charles Schumer caused the shutdown, they will blame him and his fellow Democrats. And right now, if the last shutdown was any indication, voters are more likely to blame Charles Schumer and the Senate Democrats than they are the president. So I think it is more likely that the Democrats will not be able to enact that kind of change because not enough of them are willing to endure the opprobrium of the American people for a week, 2 weeks, or a month. And I think they may very well have a point, because I don't really know what is gained from taking a stand, watching your caucus crumble, and not getting what you asked for anyway. But that's just me.
I like that you call him Charles. That's very formal. The rest of us just call him Chuck. Is that because you're new at being a Democrat? You feel like you don't know him that well yet?
That's possible. I also remember when Charles Schumer was just a congressman from Brooklyn, and he was always called Charles Schumer, so that's how I first know him. That's what I first known of him.
Oh, I see. You guys have history, you and Chuck.
You go way back.
You know, I think that Charles Schumer guy, I think he just should just shut up and dribble a basketball. I think he should stop talking about politics.
Oh,
Greg, I'm sorry. Did I step on your toe on that one?
Oh, you've been watching too much Laura Ingraham, haven't you?
Any Laura Ingraham is too much Laura Ingraham. But why don't you bring our listeners up to speed on what I'm trying to joke about?
So I guess King James did an interview in the back of an Uber, which I didn't know they did that. I guess that's the good Uber, which I don't do. And I guess he said something about how our president just doesn't care, except he said it more explicitly. And Laura Ingraham's response was, "Shut up and dribble." And pretty much. And then for some reason, she invited him on a show after she said that, which is odd. And LeBron had, it was like, "No, I won't. I'm a role model." He's the exact opposite of Michael Jordan. And he is. But if you get to watch the interview of LeBron James in the back of this Uber, it's great. And he's articulate. And he says the thing that was really interesting was he said when he was young, there were three people you could always draw inspiration from: the president of the United States, the most talented sports hero, and the most talented musician. And he's right. He said, "You may not have thought as a child," he said, "when I was young, I didn't think I could ever be president. I didn't think I could be the most talented musician, and I didn't think I could be the most talented sports hero. But these were the people who still inspired me." He goes, "It's not true anymore about the president, though." He goes, "I inspire people." And like he's saying, I am the best athlete.
He said that. I think he said, "I'm one of the leading athletes." I don't think he said,
"Yeah,
I'm the best."
I think
you know what? Even if he
it.
Said, "I am the best athlete," it's forgivable because he's LeBron
it's
James.
It's forgivable. Yeah. Well said.
He brought a championship to Cleveland. Okay.
He's a magician.
Well done.
The other thing to say about LeBron James is he has a foundation that helps kids throughout Ohio, keeps them in school, keeps them engaged in after school activities. He is personally involved in it. You know, he brings them to events and you know, knows these families and helps them out in myriad ways. This is not just a guy who dribbles and then occasionally says something on the side. This is a guy who's really putting, you know, shoe leather on the road to get stuff done and make communities a better place. He is beloved, you know, not just in Ohio, but certainly in Ohio. He's a very admired man. And so all I can picture is Laura Ingraham sitting there looking at her ratings going, I think people have forgotten me. How can I get their attention? Oh, I know. I'll insult LeBron James. Because
sure,
there's
that's
nothing
that's
going to, you know, pull focus like, you know, coming after a celebrity who really the worst you can say about him is that he held an ill-conceived press conference a few years ago.
I want to speak to this because it speaks to a bigger a sore point for me, which is when people suggest that celebrities, be they sports figures, be they actors, be they comedians, should just stick to what you do. You don't really know enough to talk about politics. You're not at the intellectual level of a Laura Ingraham or a Bill O'Reilly or a Sean Hannity. That stuff ticks me off because the beauty of America, and I don't want to, you know, the violins can now start playing, but it is that everyone gets to speak their mind. It is that all views and everybody gets to have a view and everybody gets to voice one. And yes, LeBron James and Sean Penn and people like them, Janine Garofalo, they have a bigger megaphone and more people get to hear them, but their views are just as valid. Sean Hannity was a carpenter before he went into radio. Who are these people? You know, Bill O'Reilly hosted, what was it, Access Hollywood or Inside? I mean, he hosted some entertainment show. Why are they the experts and other people should just shut up and dribble?
The fact of the matter is, though, you know, Laura was looking to bump up her ratings, perhaps. Whether she did that or not, I don't know. But, you know, if 2016 is any indication, yeah, even LeBron James could be president of the United States.
I'm okay with that.
But I don't want to – I want to actually stay on the topic of democratizing, you know, political
debate
discussions. Because it leads into a topic that we've been wanting to hit on for quite a while, the art of podcasts themselves. You know, it used to be that you had to be on a cable news channel or at a network or be a columnist or a reporter for a major newspaper to be able to opine about politics in this country. Then social media came and everyone can go on Facebook and they can write out their opinions, whether it's in an original post, whether it's in a comment on someone else's post. And blogs obviously democratized opinion quite a bit. But this new format, podcasts, I think has really taken us a quantum leap forward. We're here doing this podcast. I just wanted to talk for a little while about the format, why we do this, what we like about it, other podcasts that we like, and frankly, see if there's any, you know, downside to it. So with that in mind, I'm going to just throw this open to you guys. It's a topic we wanted to talk about for a while. Why do you do this show? Why do you like this show? And what do you think about the fact that none of us are attorneys, none of us are politicians or, you know, high-level political consultants, and yet here we are telling our views and people actually listen and in large numbers. Why do you think that is?
Because we're so cute. I mean, look at us. We're adorable. Oh.
Yeah, we are precious. We are
that really
precious.
That really doesn't fly in the world. Because I think there is an appeal to hearing the everyman, or in my case, every feminist. I'm not just a woman. I'm a feminist woman. You know, talking and sharing opinions that aren't going over your head, that are, you know, that are coming from a place of common experience. I think that's valuable, and it feels like having a conversation with people that you know and people that you like. At least I hope you guys like us.
Greg, what do you think?
Yeah, I have to agree. It's me making that connection with people who you seem to are, I don't want to say family, because if it's, you know, family, then usually they're shouting and someone throwing something. But like a nice family. Yeah. Like a family that doesn't involve as much yelling. But in addition to that, getting some different viewpoints with people that you like.
Yeah.
Different viewpoints in different areas of expertise. The four of us could not come from more different backgrounds in terms of what we've done professionally and personally. We know a whole lot of different stuff.
That helps.
Right.
And I think that's actually the key, is that if this is a, these podcasts are the chance for folks who have certain areas of expertise, but who did not know somebody in media, who did not know somebody with a newspaper, to get the word out and to spread that knowledge outward. And it's also, frankly, due to the fact that the institutions that provided information for so long, to some extent, fell down on the job. You know, people were looking for lack of a better term, alternative sources of information. And, you know, when they found that Fox News sort of jumped into schizophrenia, folks were looking for something outside of the big three and outside of the one newspaper in their town. And podcasts give that to them. It gives them the chance to hear other points of view that they would not normally be able to access. And that's why they flock to them. And I am just happy that there are enough people who are willing to listen to us warble.
Well, just in political podcasts, I think there's several different subgenres. And I'm going to talk about a couple that I happen to like. I love Pod Save America. And, you know, the people at Quicken Media now have like three or four variants on that. There's Pod Save the World. There's Crooked something or other. They have all these different,
yeah,
like,
Love It
offshoot,
or Leave It, love which is it almost leave a comedy it. Show.
Yeah. They're all interesting.
Pod Save the People. Yeah. They attract so many really awesome guests. You know, they're able to.
Well, it's hosted by two guys that used to work in the Obama White House, John Lovett and I'm blanking
John
on
Favreau.
The other.
It's actually four guys. It's Tommy Vietor, John Favreau, John Lovett, and Dan Pfeiffer, who are all Obama staffers.
Right, and so they obviously they have expertise in the area of politics. They get tremendous guests. They have insights because they worked in a White House.
Yeah, they know what the difference is between normal and what we've got going on now.
Right.
That's what's really great about them.
There is one thing about podcasts that that is losing me a little bit is when they start to make them into live shows. And I notice Pod Save America now, almost every other week, they're on the road and they've got an audience of 500 or 1,000 people and they're playing to the auditorium. Not my favorite format of the podcast, but but they do have a lot of good information. So those are the ones I listen to.
We could do that. I would love to do that.
I was going to say, I mean, we could probably sell out an elementary school gym.
Well, we could try.
We should try that once.
We should see if we can get like an NRA chapter to sponsor.
You know what? I am 10 miles from the NRA. I could be there in 15 minutes.
What do you guys happen to like and why?
Well, I gotta give a shout out to Pantsuit Politics. Sarah was on the show last week, one of the co-hosts. So, without a doubt, I've always enjoyed that. What else do I listen to relative? Meet the Press. Their podcast is actually their last week's show.
Right. A lot of the podcasts are really just, they take the audio from a television show and just repurpose it.
Right, and I love that about them. So that one I find really funny, especially I think Jake Tapper does that too. If I miss the show,
they all
for
do. Morning
reason.
Joe, Bill Moore, they all do the same thing.
All
it's
the
really
NPR
cheating.
Shows do. It's like, yeah, the This American Life podcast was in fact This American Life yesterday.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So,
but they leave
the
cussing
shows,
in.
Right. 60 Minutes does that too.
Right. So to me, that's cheating. Those people, I don't, you know,
you don't
care for.
That a
real
podcast?
Original content, baby. You got that right here. That's why we're the best podcast.
Now, another thing that I wanted to address, and we've kind of addressed this on the show before, but so many of our fans bring this up in one form or another that I just want to address the idea that people sometimes get upset because they say, we like the podcast, we like the personalities, but you guys all come from the same place. You don't have a conservative voice on this topic or that topic. And we don't get the balance. And I want to speak to that. You know, this show is not meant to be balanced. We do use the line, real debate without the hate. And we do. We have differences of opinion. And we debate them with, you know, I think some good camaraderie and some understanding and tolerance. But the idea that every podcast has to have both sides of the story, Listen, folks, if you want that, go watch CNN. Go watch it when they have six people on the panel and three of them are conservatives and three of them are liberals. If you want that, you know, go to Left, Right, and Center. It's out there for you. That's not what we do here. We are four people who like each other, who share our Sunday nights together talking politics. And on a lot of issues, we tend to see them from the same slant. And if that's not your cup of tea, we don't want to lose you as a listener, but that's what we do. So please stop asking why we don't have millennials on the show or conservatives on the show or more people of color on the show. There's nothing wrong with that, but that's not what we do. What we do is four friends who really like politics, think we know a fair amount about politics, shooting the breeze every week and doing our own analysis. We try to do it with laughs. We try to do it in an engaging manner. This is not meant to be a balanced look at the news every week. And neither is Pod Save America, which is the number one podcast in America.
And that's the beauty.
Yeah, and I think building on what Kevin says is this is the equivalent of a virtual couch. We're all sitting on the virtual couch, you know, with our drinks on the coffee table. Well, Rebecca and I have drinks on the coffee table. I can't speak to Kevin and Greg. Just shooting the breeze on this sort of thing. And that, you know, that's who we are. And if you've been a longtime listener, then you will know, you know, certainly that I have had a very unusual political journey. And that's the kind of thing that you're supposed to follow and supposed to be interested in. What are they going to say this week? What are they going to say that is different from what they said last week? Have any of them changed their minds on something? You know, Kevin has shifted himself leftward on gun control as a result of what happened in Parkland. The 2016 campaign, you know, threw me around like a Martian Congressional Republic naval vessel coming into combat maneuvers out of 3G without a crash couch. That's what happened to me, folks. And it happened every single week. And you heard it here on MPU as I went through my journey of pain.
I remember the days when Greg really liked John Kasich.
I don't remember any of those.
Actually, John Kasich's begging for gun control right now.
Yes.
But, you know, something, you know, what you were saying about podcasts being a democratization of dialogue, if you want a podcast that does have, you know, a more balanced cast or, you know, provides a point counterpoint from different sides of an issue, those exist. You know, every podcast can have its own flavor, do its own thing.
Exactly.
And, you know, if we're not providing X, X is out there. Go
That's
find
right.
it. Go, or better
shoot.
Yet, start it.
Right.
Do it.
Right.
Be
but
a podcaster.
Don't impose it on us.
we're kind of a one-trick pony. We can't. Although, you know, we have been getting out there. You'll get to hear me talking to another podcaster named Jordan Cooper, who's you know, he does lots of really great interviews, and he and I did a cross interview session this week, and that was really great to talk to somebody else who is doing something different and to hear what his mission is in his podcast, which is called the Public Interest Podcast, and for him to talk to me a little bit about what we do.
And we're going to actually have part of that discussion after this little ad that we're going to do for another sponsor of the More Perfect Union. We love our sponsors. Folks, we're actually making money at this. We're actually professionals at this.
Don't tell them. Our secret is out.
And the dough is rolling in from these ads. But we do have a new sponsor. Well, actually, this is their second week with us. Deep Dish on Global Affairs. It's a podcast from the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. And if you enjoy us, we think you actually will enjoy the Deep Dish. It's a weekly podcast going beyond the headlines on critical issues around the globe. And yes, they sound like they should be a Chicago pizzeria. We know that.
I'm hungry for knowledge.
But seriously, you could order yourself a Deep Dish pizza and listen to Deep Dish serve up guests to talk about the news of the world. They've had a NATO ambassador talking about the Russian aggression, which is way more qualified to talk about it than the four of us. A Navy admiral to talk about competition in the South China Sea, who would probably understand that analogy that DJ just laid out for us that I didn't get. People from the White House, Korea experts, all kinds of really interesting people.
That's right. They had an economist break down NAFTA negotiations. And again, yes, they talk about foreign and military threats from North Korea and places like that. So it's really, if you're into foreign affairs, DJ is really into foreign affairs. He has his own Facebook page about British politics and European politics. And if you like that, you're going to really like the Deep Dish. So subscribe to the Deep Dish on Global Affairs to have the hottest intel delivered straight to you. And that's yet another podcast that we could recommend. But I did want to come back to what Rebecca was talking about right before we got to that. So, Rebecca, you met this week with a gentleman who does another podcast. His name is Jordan Cooper. What's the name of his podcast again?
The Public Interest Podcast. And he does interviews with people who are engaged in different types of public service, elected officials, people who've been appointees in different governments, state, federal, local, folks in the nonprofit sector. And what he's really trying to do, and this is so interesting because it's a very different take on it, is he's not a partisan and he's not trying to get the party line. He's just trying to address the idea of what public service actually looks like in practice, and getting people to tell their stories of being in service to the public.
So with that in mind, let's go and listen to a little bit of that conversation right now.
I'm Rebecca Kushmider. I'm here today with Jordan Cooper. He is the host of the Public Interest Podcast and a candidate for Maryland delegate in Maryland's 16th district. Welcome, Jordan.
Thanks so much, Rebecca. Glad to be here.
Oh, we're happy to have you. So I wanted to talk a little bit first about your podcast. You are trying to talk to folks about public service and their role in government, in the nonprofit world, and you don't make it political. Mm-hmm. You talk strictly about service. Tell me how that works.
So, Public Interest Podcast, and you can find it at publicinterestpodcast.com or any place where you've listened to podcasts. It was started, basically, it grew out of my campaign to represent Bethesda in the Maryland House of Delegates in 2014. And I was running for office, and people would come up to me and say, Jordan, you seem like such a nice guy. Why are you running for office? You know, why do you want to be a politician? They're all terrible guys. And I said, well, you know, I've been in politics. At that point, I'd been in it for a decade already. And I said, I know many of these individuals, and they're wonderful people. They're noble. They're honorable. They're trying to advance the public interest, but they're kind of boring, right? So, you know, they're taking care of constituent services. They are trying to work on a certain very wonky sort of bill that they're passing in session. And those things aren't newsworthy, especially in an era when the local newspaper was shut down, when Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post. There isn't just coverage of the good things. So usually when you read about politicians, it's negative. So what I thought was, well, why don't I try to provide people with an opportunity to virtually meet these politicians while focusing exclusively on good news, right? So I have all the scandals and everything that's taken care of by traditional media. But for me, I was trying to show the man or the woman behind the title. So, and so in that way, I was hoping that a libertarian Republican guest from Texas might be listened to by a Democrat, and that you might understand that, you know, this is still a good person who just disagrees with you. If I could get those sorts of guests on, maybe my listenership could be exposed to them, and that would create more tolerance and productive civil discourse.
Now, you have interviewed a lot of people at this point. Your guest list includes former Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff. You have interviewed Governor O'Malley. Mm-hmm. You were talking to Andy Shriver?
Mark Shriver,
I'm sorry, who is the CEO of the Save the Children Action Fund. Who has been your favorite guest? I mean, not including myself. Jordan did just interview me, and obviously I'm going to be his favorite, but the people who aren't sitting in this kitchen, who was your favorite guest?
You know, they're interesting episodes. There's so many different perspectives. Another thing I tried to do was make the podcast accessible for a larger audience. I wanted people to listen to the podcast and say, you know, I have no interest in being a politician, but I wanted to provide that individual with an option, a motivation to pursue public service, even if it's not political. So half of my podcast are with rabbis and doctors and lawyers and nonprofit executive directors, and everyone brings a wide variety of perspectives to the show. Some of my favorite episodes have been, for instance, with Tom Daschle, the former U.S. Senate Majority Leader, and he spoke about a time when he was in Congress and he visited an old man in a ranch in the middle of the Dakotas. And it was late at night, maybe he came by around 10 a.m. or 10 p.m. or so, and was talking to this guy, and he said, you know, Tom, when you go back to Washington, I want you to remember that I don't know what you're doing, and I don't understand the policies that you're voting on, and I trust you. But he said, whenever you make a decision, look at those two photos right there above my fireplace. And there were photos of the guy's grandkids. And he said, I want you to remember those two kids every time you take a vote and say, how will it affect them? And if you do that for me, then I think you'll do a good job in Washington. And then so Tom said, oh, thank you very much. He got in his car, drove home. At about 6 in the morning, he got a message from one of his staff people to let him know that the guy he had just spoken to at 10 or 11 at night had passed away since he left. So in fact, Tom was the last human being that man ever spoke to in this world. And he carried that with him for decades afterwards. And so that sort of that very strongly, very poignantly impacted me. So there's just so many fascinating perspectives that I've gotten from many guests on my show.
Now, you are, in fact, a candidate right now.
Mm-hmm.
You're running for the House of Delegates. How are you messaging your candidacy? I mean, you work very hard not to bring your personal politics to bear on your podcast. You act strictly as an interviewer. So it must be a real code switch when you're campaigning to be talking about what you believe and what you want to do and what you want to accomplish and what your own version of public service would look like in Annapolis.
Sure. So when I've interviewed journalists, I've interviewed CNN and Bloomberg News and CBS, national news anchors, and they all have opinions. But you're right. It is quite another thing to publicly have a political persona and simultaneously, not a different time in your life, but simultaneously have a political persona.
Now, clearly, you are the wonky type. You like the details. You like the weeds. Mm-hmm. You like to get into it. So when you look at political conversation on the macro level, you look at the shock journalism that we've all seen really rise up in maybe the past 10 years, and certainly gotten worse in the past two. What do you think we could do to improve the national dialogue so that people were spending less time yelling at each other on Twitter and more time thinking about solutions?
So that's why I created Public Interest Podcast. The tagline is Revealing Our Humanity. I think there's sort of a negative spiral where we are dehumanizing people who disagree with us. And as you mentioned, back and forth on Twitter, you don't really know or see the person that you dislike. I think that if you really get to speak and engage with and get to know people who have different opinions, you may come to see their common humanity. I just took a trip down to Mississippi to a very red area just to hang out with some guys that I know and see their perspectives. We are on opposite ends of the political spectrum, but I think what this nation needs to have more productive dialogue is, one, to acknowledge that people who disagree with us may still have good intentions, that they're not terrible people trying to destroy the nation and the world.
Wait, you mean that just because somebody wants to go into deficit reduction, they're not trying to destroy America?
So, you know...
Really? Are you sure? Because I've been on Twitter, and it sounds real different over there.
Right. So, and another thing is that, So people aren't trying to destroy the country just because they have a different point of view. And if you get to have dialogue with them and engage with them in conversation, I think you may begin to see that also that we're not so different. You find in current news media, and especially most of the country has competitive primaries instead of competitive generals, you find that people are really focusing on the 10 or 15% that we disagree upon. Mm-hmm. But what I've noticed, especially in interviewing Republicans and Democrats, former members of Congress on my podcast, I found that it seems like most of, maybe I'm making up these numbers, but maybe 80% of what everyone's talking about, everyone agrees with. And that the media focuses on the 15% or so where everyone disagrees. But I think if we really get into dialogue with each other, we'll find that many of us agree on the vast majority of things. And we're driving wedges within our country, between us, with people who disagree from us, merely on a small portion of the whole subject matter.
Who is your 2020 dream team?
For president?
For president and vice president. Who would you pick?
Frankly, you know, I may want to see someone who promises to diminish the power of the presidency. Ever since FDR, The presidency has been growing and growing in scope. And as we can see, for those Republicans who did not like Barack Obama and for those Democrats who do not like Donald Trump, you kind of feel like, gosh, I wish they didn't have as much power as they do have. I wish more of the power were vested in the Congress, which is directly elected by us, as is the presidency. But the presidency is actually elected by electoral college, not popular vote.
Which is another set of issues that should probably be addressed in the next decade. All right. Well, thank you for coming. Thank you for being part of this. We appreciate it. And again, this is Jordan Cooper. He's the host of the Public Interest Podcast. And this has been Rebecca Kushmider for the More Perfect Union.
Okay. So that was Rebecca's conversation with Jordan. And also, by the way, I don't know whether he really hit on this as hard in that particular clip as we wanted to, but Jordan's also running for political office. What's he running for again? Do you remember, Rebecca?
He's running for the State House of Delegates here in Maryland. He's a couple districts over from me, so I won't have the opportunity to pull a lever for him. But he's running for state delegate, and I wish him all the luck in the world on his campaign.
That's right. So Jordan, we wish you luck. We want people to go to find Jordan's website. Jordan Cooper is his name. You know, we had one of our podcast brethren from very early in the run of the More Perfect Union went on to run for the House of Delegates in Virginia and won. And Emily Brewer is now a successful politician in Virginia, and we're very proud of that. So maybe Jordan will join that fold.
Yeah, maybe we have some good juju.
Yeah, a little More Perfect Union magic going on.
No, we used to get Joe Biden on here, maybe get him to be president.
I didn't get a chance to ask before, DJ, are there any particular podcasts that you enjoy or don't enjoy?
I would say, I'm going to throw a curveball again, probably the one I enjoy the most is the Coffee House Shots, which is the podcast for the Spectator magazine in London. It usually is Fraser Nelson and, I forget the other guy, but Fraser Nelson is usually the fellow who runs that one. They have Isabel Hardman and various other folks who write for The Spectator to give their take on British politics. Of course, as everyone knows, I'm far too much into British politics and it's healthy for me. But if you are interested in the internal political machinations of what is still our strongest ally and closest friend, that's one of the good places to go.
Cool. So with that in mind, we want to thank everybody for listening to our little podcast that can. Please follow us on Twitter at #MPUPodcast and on Facebook at facebook.com/MorePerfectUnionPodcast and share our link on your Facebook timeline so your friends can find the magic of More Perfect Union and enjoy us as well. And if you like debating politics yourself, you can come and join us in our Facebook group, Open Fire Politics. We're all there. We'd love to see you there, too. You know, you can debate with Rebecca, with Greg, with DJ, with other people. We tend to yell and scream at each other there. That's actually fake debate with a lot of hate. Too much hate, but it can still be a lot of fun. People are there this week talking about the shooting in Florida and gun rights and the Russian investigation. So if you have thoughts about those that you want to share with the world, that might be the place to go.
And quite a few Russians talk about the Russian investigation on Open Fire, too.
And occasionally we get some Russian trolls in there who we have to chase out. But if you've never seen what a Russian troll looks like, come and ask for one. We'll point you to somebody. With that in mind, any last thoughts for the week to come?
Yeah, Kasich is still an asshole.